Hi there, Matt.
Hey, Bill, how are you?
Great to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you again.
So this was, I'd say it's a busy week, but they all seem like busy weeks politically these days.
Yeah, this was an interesting week. I mean, well, just today we had Barack Obama doing that online, you know, tele-town hall, I guess. And we had an Obama speech this week. A lot of crazy stuff happening.
Big budget stuff, but perhaps one of the bigger blog stories was the reaction to Senator Spector's flip-flop on the Employee Free Choice Act.
Yeah, a very interesting story. It's actually something I've been following for a long time, and as you can imagine, conservative blogs were buzzing about it. I mean, and there's so many different factors. I mean, Right Wing News, which is a very good blog, sort of started off with this story that leaked out, I guess, late last week, early this week, about how labor unions had apparently pledged to give, you know, millions and millions of dollars to Spector's campaign if he were to vote for card check or the Employee Free Choice Act, as you may call it. Then we had folks like Jim Anthel over at American Spectator and a lot of other people talk about, you know, Pat Toomey, who's, you know, he's a conservative from Pennsylvania, runs the Club for Growth now, former congressman. He almost beat Spector last time. And Jim Antle is reporting on this new Quinnipiac poll that came out yesterday that shows Toomey with a 41-27 lead over Spector. And then sort of the latest thing that happened is a lot of bloggers, including Phil Klein, also at American Spectator, and Hot Air, also put up a quote from Pat Toomey that he released right after news of Spector's decision to oppose cloture and the final vote. Pat Toomey issued a statement essentially, you know, saying that he's doing it for political reasons. So, yeah, it was a very interesting story, and it continues to develop.
Certainly, folks on the left were not thrilled with Spector's move. And also calling him out for politics, Jason Rosenbaum at the Seminole, people should be calling out Spector's political move for what it is. He's participating in obstructionism, and he's making it harder for our economy to recover, all because he perceives a bigger threat from the discredited and disempowered right than he does from an ascendant left. It's a strange choice, and a choice that will likely cost him. So it obviously the political landscape is interpreted wholly differently by the left and the right, I'm sure.
But, yeah, and the other interesting thing about this story, though, in addition to conservatives generally being happy and liberals generally being upset, there's also this spin going on, including Politico. The front page of Politico, I believe yesterday, they had a story essentially arguing that this is good for Barack Obama and for Democrats because it Obama now doesn't have to make this tough decision, and that's just ridiculous. I mean, you could use that logic to argue that anytime a political side wins, it's a loss, and anytime, you know, there's always going to be some backlash. So that's the other interesting part of this.
Well, David Sirota at Open Left was very critical of a MSNBC First Read report that said that the White House was genuinely happy that Spector did that because it took the issue off the table. They didn't want to be forced to choose between labor and big business when they would have definitely chosen labor if the bill reached their desk, but they didn't want to, quote, stick a finger in business's eye. David Schroeder said, if you believe NBC News' reporting, the White House's priority is not sticking a finger in business's eye in order to slightly increase workers' union rights. This is indeed a major if. In one way, this story smells. Obama's always been a friend to unions. In another way, this story seems not entirely unbelievable. Many people inside Obama's administration have often been enemies of unions and the labor movement, and many of them may have been happy they don't have to deal with a union priority. Also, it's not unbelievable that while Obama supports the Employee Free Choice Act, he may not be interested in expending political capital to pass it. On that last score, actions will speak a hell of a lot louder than words. And I think also Jane Hampshire at Fargo Lake said, you know, put the pressure on Obama to say, look, it's your job to rally support around this, regardless of what Senator Spector does. So there is some consternation on the left on that score. But I I always got the impression from the White House that they do want to pass this, but as far as priorities go this year, all the major crises around them, banking, healthcare, energy, let alone foreign policy, this didn't seem to be as time sensitive to them, and they're not upset that it gets pushed off going forward. But again, proof's in the pudding as far as how the White House reacts to it. And so far, the reaction has been silence.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think that the one thing that there were essentially two issues this year that conservatives are very worked up about. One is the so-called fairness doctrine. The other is card check. And the problem, the reason the conservatives are very upset about both issues are that they essentially are long-term things that rig the game. So in other words, if the fairness doctrine were enacted, it's not just going to affect one election cycle, or it's over time, it would impact the ability for conservatives to get their message out. Same thing with card check, or the employee fairness doctrine, whatever we want to call it. I mean, if that goes through, we know there will be more labor unions and more labor members. And what's going to essentially happen is there will be more union dues, I would argue forcibly taken from the pockets of workers, going to fund Democratic candidates. And so there's long-term implications, and I think that's why we see, you know, liberals fighting very hard for this and conservatives fighting very hard to stop it, because the stakes are very high. The other interesting thing to sort of come out of this is Grover Norquist, who's a, you know, conservative leader who's actually been very supportive of Specter over the years, was one of the first people to announce the news. And it's very interesting because Specter, this was a big issue for Grover, and he runs Americans for Tax Reform. And so card check was a huge issue that they've been concerned about and fighting for. This gives, there will be some conservative leaders, possibly Grover Norquist, possibly David Keene from the American Conservative Union, who are both personally close to Specter. He may actually still enjoy the support of some conservative leaders. And that primary in Pennsylvania with Toomey versus Specter will be very interesting. Specter can't become an independent. He can't lose the Republican primary and become an independent the way Joe Lieberman did. Pennsylvania law won't allow that, so it's going to be fascinating.
I guess there's an open question whether Specter has successfully mended ties with the conservative movement over this. I know the Plumb Line raised the question whether or not this was too little too late for Specter to win the plaudits of conservatives. News Hoggers wrote, has the courting process by both unions and prominent Dems, either though it is a short-run failure, been sufficient to cement the impression of mistrust that conservative Republicans have of Senator Specter? Has Senator Specter been hugged to political death? Now, you're suggesting that perhaps that's not the case, that Specter has saved himself in the eyes of the conservative movement.
No, I wouldn't say that. I think that he has gone too far. And I think the vast majority of conservatives will not support him. They will support Toomey. I honestly don't see how Specter can beat Toomey if a Republican primary should occur between the two of them, which seems likely.
Does this mean then that, I mean, Specter was a critical vote to get the stimulus bill through? One of the few Republicans willing to side with Democrats and avoid filibusters. Are you suggesting that this is a sign that he is going to stop doing that until this primary is done?
Well, I think that if there are any close votes, he will go conservative. And I think that clearly the card check bill is an example. He, you know, and he, by the way, here's an argument. Let me just say, I think this is interesting. I find myself agreeing with, say, liberals like Marcos Melitzas at the Daily Kos about a lot of not policy, not philosophy, not ideology, but essentially he's a liberal who fought off the moderates in his party successfully, and the Democratic Party, I think, is arguably better today, more successful today because he was successful at that. In many ways, I see some of the things that I believe in parallel to that. And so, you know, I think it's interesting that we're essentially going to have the same sort of fight here. I think that, you know, there will be people who are establishment types who will back Spectre. But I support primaries, and I think primaries are very healthy. And there's a lot of Republicans who say it's dangerous to primary a Republican. But this is a prime example. If Pat Toomey had not threatened to primary Arlen Specter, I'd be willing to bet Specter would have voted for Karnczak.
He voted for it before.
He did in 07. So I think that, you know, there is a very good argument to make that even if you're not able to oust an incumbent, the fear of running a strong is sort of a lobbying technique, you know, the danger of running somebody to the right of them, or if you're in a Democratic primary to the left of them, may be enough to keep them honest. So it's interesting.
It could have ramifications for the rest of the president's agenda if it's not just a one-shot. I mean, Spector's got to make a decision. Is he going to keep dancing on both sides of the line to show how independent he is, or is he making a decision that he has to show his conservative side to get through this primary?
Yeah, I think he's going to have to go to the right if he's going to stay in the Republican primary. I don't see how he can do anything else. The other interesting thing is the Minnesota race, right? I mean, if Al Franken was in the Senate, that completely changes the dynamics here as well.
Sure.
Or if Coleman were in, so.
Absolutely. Everyone's waiting with bated breath for that to finally finish.
Yeah.
So you had another conservative blog, Scooplet, that caught your eye.
Yeah, this is very fascinating. I'm very interested in this one. My friend Adam Brickley, who started the draft Sarah Palin movement, I think he actually spotted Palin and started pushing for her in, I think, January or February of 07, you know, like a year and a half before most people knew who Sarah Palin was. He's come up with this idea over at – there's a blog called Race for 2012. It used to be called Race for 2008. And he sort of posed the idea that that Judd Gregg should run for vice president. And quickly another blogger named Matthew Miller at Race for 2012 said, well, why not run him not just for vice president but for president? And it's a fascinating sort of argument as to why. Part of the rationale is that – Obama gave Judd Gregg credibility when he picked him to be his, Commerce Secretary. That's sort of a tacit endorsement of his credibility. Since that time, Gregg, who used to sort of be thought of as just by Republicans, he was thought of as he's a New England Republican, we'll tolerate him, but he's not really one of us. Since that time, he's been a very outspoken and eloquent critic of Obama. And sort of throw in the whole environment that Republicans are facing, where we're very afraid of becoming this isolated, you know, southern geographic party that can't win outside the Deep South. You know, the prospects of having a New England former governor, U.S. senator, you know, who's very fiscally conservative running, it's a fascinating idea. And normally I might even just dismiss it. But the fact that Brickley, who spotted Sarah Palin so early on, I think, you know, gives this thing some legs.
Does Judd Gregg want to follow Adam's prescience and follow in Sarah Palin's footsteps is the question.
We'll see. It would be funny if he got picked and then self-destructed or something. Then it'll be like the Brickley curse. It's like being on the cover of Sports Illustrated, maybe.
Do you know how he feels about his backing of Palin and playing a role and putting her in the spotlight?
No, Adam is a very big supporter of Sarah Palin. He actually still blogs about her frequently at Race for 2012. He also has his own blog called The Brickyard. And he's a big, big supporter of Palin. I mean, as am I. I wrote that one critical thing over, as I talked about last week, that got me in the David Frum category. But I'm a supporter of Palin. I think she generally got a raw deal. And, I think Brickley is, by the way, Brickley, he was sort of, the man about town there for a while. He was on the Colbert Report. He was in the New Yorker. So he got a lot of publicity out of picking Palin. So who knows? Maybe we'll be, maybe he'll be like the guy behind Judd Gregg or something.
Palin Gregg 012.
That's right.
Well, in the liberal blog, actually, one more thing about the conservative blogosphere that sort of crossed in the liberal blogosphere that I thought was interesting. A number of liberal blogs caught notice of a growing meme on the right attacking Obama for being reliant on the teleprompter and even suggesting that he's just not a very smart person, period. Washington Independence, David Weigel wrote, sort of flagged a conservative trend. Obama had made a joke where he thanked himself, making a joke
right.
about a glitch on a teleprompter at a St. Patrick's Day event, and he joked and said, first, I'd like to say thank you to President Obama, joking that there was a teleprompter problem. And some conservatives ran with that and tried to call that a gaffe to show how reliant he was on it. James Fallows at The Atlantic was sort of incredulous at criticisms after the press conference and talked about the importance of using teleprompters to have very clear and strong presentations as president. Steve Bennett at The Washington Monthly says, if recent commentary on far-right blogs is any indication they've come up with a new one, they're convinced the president isn't very bright. Now, it's always been one of the few attacks the right would go out of its way to avoid. For one thing, they defended George W. Bush, despite his, shall we say, intellectual limitations. For another, I'd assume even diehard Republicans would grudgingly acknowledge Obama's intelligence, much the same way a liberal lawyer might reluctantly respect Justice John Roberts' intellect, even while disagreeing with him and everything. Apparently, though, that's not the case. Quite a few of the leading far-right bloggers have convinced themselves the president, all evidence to the contrary notwithstanding, is a dim bulb. Do you see this notion taking hold? And if it is taking hold, any expectation that it would actually become part of President Obama's reputation?
Well, it's an interesting thing. I've not written about this myself. But and there's actually now a blog, right? Isn't it like Barack Obama's teleprompter or something.com? And I've been invited to join several Barack Obama's teleprompter Facebook groups as well. I've not joined any of them yet. The one thing I would take a little bit of issue with, I can't put my finger on what the message is, but I don't think the implication is that Obama's not smart. But maybe that he's very scripted. So I'm a little bit maybe not 100% sure that that's what it is. But I do feel that this meme is catching on, and there's something about it. You know, it's hard to predict what's going to stick and what's not going to stick. And there's something about this that I think could become sort of a leitmotif, you know, or something that goes forward. I can't quite put my finger on why this has resonated, but I do not believe it's that he's not – I don't think the implication is that he's not smart, but – I haven't been able to really drill down on the what does this say about him, but clearly he is very tied to the teleprompter, more so than other presidents. You know, everybody uses a teleprompter when they give the State of the Union speech, but he apparently, even a very small crowd of like a dozen people or something, he would use a teleprompter too. So that's what strikes me as a little bit odd about it.
Well, as Fallows said, the whole Obama can't talk on his own continent is bizarre, given his performance through 2 years of stump speeches and debates during the campaign, let alone actually doing the primetime press conference where you're answering questions without a teleprompter. So it seems hard to create this image of a guy. I mean, not to mention all the town halls that he's been doing. It just seems very strange that you could possibly treat this guy as if he's a robot. And I wonder, because during the campaign, there was a cadre of conservative bloggers that were out debunking conservative conspiracy theories as a way to say to other conservatives, look, this is a bad path to go down. You want to beat this guy, beat him on reality. Don't beat him on completely cockamamie made-up stuff. Could this be one of those things that might feel good going down, a way to tell yourself that Obama is not what this media concoction, the way the liberal media makes him out to be, but it only stays within the conservative bubble and it doesn't get out to the wider public and it makes it harder to communicate to the rest of the country what your own ideas are.
I mean, I think ridicule can be an effective political weapon. Sometimes it's for psychological warfare, even if it doesn't have a sort of a message to the public, it can change the way politicians and their staff react to things. I think it's I know that we're supposed to be speculating, but I think it's kind of early to tell. I think this is something we should keep an eye on. This may be the beginning of something that's gonna catch on. You know, John Edwards' hair. I mean, there's certain, like, even if they're stupid little things, sometimes they stick with people. And this may be one of those things, or maybe it's much ado about nothing. But I'm not sure either way at this point.
Shall we make an appointment to revisit in a month?
I think we should. Let's put that down on our schedule.
Okay. The other, if we can get wonky for a bit, the budget obviously is the big policy story this week. And to get detailed, Obama had in his budget proposal a fund for health care for over $634 billion over the course of a 10-year window. That's a down payment on what broader health care reform would cost, and separately also an assumption of revenue from a carbon cap and trade global warming strategy. Presuming revenue there means you'd be making polluters pay for the right to pollute the sky. Both those things got some pushback among some more right-leaning Senate Democrats, and the way the Senate Budget Committee chairman handled it was to assume that there would be funds for health care, funds for clean energy, but not put any dollar figure on it. Just, it's a placeholder. And that sort of punts the issue for Congress to write separate legislation on those subjects down the road. As it relates to health care, there was interesting dialogue between Jonathan Cohn at the New Republic blog, The Treatment, Ezra Klein at The American Prospect, and Igor Volsky at The Wonk Room, part of the Center for American Progress blogs. Ezra and Cohn both took a positive take from that. Cohn had, in talking to other reformers, saying he's come out against paying for health care with higher income. I'm trying to find a good quote here. Keeping reconciliation out of the Senate budget proposal, but including in the House, allows congressional leaders to pursue a good cop, bad cop strategy. This means that the House is trying to put health care reform legislation within the budget. The Senate is not. Once each chamber passes its budget, the two must get together and work out differences between their versions. As long as reconciliation is in the House, it will be on the table. And by that time, the thinking goes, leaders in both houses will have a better sense of whether it's necessary to use it. One more reason reformers seem generally happy is Senator Conrad. He's come out against paying for health care with higher income taxes on the wealthy, which will make it tougher to raise the revenue. But he has not suggested that health care itself will have to wait. In the opinion of most, that means he's not going to be the obstruction some feared he would be. Ezra Klein went on to say, Conrad is actually doing a 5-year budget, not a 10. The policy implications of that is he's allowing health care to be scored under a 10-year time frame, so the initial investments in the system reform have time to pay themselves off. The system, in other words, doesn't have to be deficit neutral over 5 years, which would see the bulk of the upfront investments, but over 10, when those investments should begin paying their dividends. Max Baucus said, I'm very happy that healthcare reform does not have to be paid for in the first 5 years. We could not do meaningful reform otherwise. So that was the positive wonky takes on it. Whereas Igor Volsky at Wonk Room said, Conrad is willing to die. Theoretically, Congress could now spend more than $634 billion in health care, but it also could end up spending less, a lot less. So it's an open question whether Congress is going to have the political will to put the money on the table. That's where that fight is lying ahead. The White House is taking a positive spin on that budget and saying the basic concepts of healthcare and clean energy are there, but those fights are going to be fought for another day, it seems.
Definitely be interesting. It's something to watch liberal bloggers sort of take that up, which is something that they it's a new opportunity. Obviously, you guys are in control now, so these are kind of fights that didn't take place before for obvious reasons. It's interesting to watch Conrad. I was sort of under the impression that he was a pretty hard left liberal who masqueraded as a conservative to win election in North Dakota, but it seems like he actually is going to be, you know, standing up for and opposing the president on some of this stuff. So,
well, he took a very hard line publicly saying don't put health care in budget reconciliation. And the procedural issue with that, if you haven't heard it already, is if it's under Senate budget rules, being in the budget reconciliation process means it can't be filibustered. You could pass with 51 votes,
right,
as opposed to...
But it's also temporary, right?
I'm sorry?
So, but the legislation would then also be temporary.
I think that you have to sort of do it every single year.
Right. It's like, that's why the Bush tax cuts aren't permanent.
Right.
That's why they have to keep renewing, would have to renew them. So there is an argument to be made if you're a liberal who really wants to have this be a long-term thing. You could oppose reconciliation under... completely different grounds.
Yeah, but no one is. I mean, everyone on the left would assume once you got it passed that way, you got the policy mechanisms out the door. They were going to last.
Good,
they
I
wouldn't
mean,
just.
I think
fade.
They're pretty smart because government once government grows or once, you know, people get something from government, it never goes back. So it's probably a pretty smart move
as long as
for
it
liberals.
Works.
Well, I would argue that a lot of stuff hasn't worked, but once we got it, we never got rid of it.
This is where you and I would disagree.
Yeah, that's where we part ways. So.
But there's other tricks with that, in that you have to write the legislation a certain way so it directly relates to the budget. It can't be struck by another parliamentary procedure. So, you know, the White House would say, look, it's not ideal to write legislation in that way. It's not our preference, but... if that's the way it's going to have to be, because we look at healthcare as a crisis situation, that is the main fiscal threat for all the budget hawks worrying about long-term debt. Healthcare costs are the primary driver, so you got to deal with that. And if you take the climate seriously, you got to deal with carbon emissions. So they're basically trying to tell Congress, look, you're right, it's better legislatively to do this through traditional means, but if you're not going to play ball, we got another avenue here, and we're going to use it. So the
White
House is still saying it's on the table.
This.
So we'll see. But they're getting some pushback from 10 Democrats on that. Certain 7 Democrats.
We talked about this last week, but I still would argue that this is an example, if this happens, of the Democrats copying the worst behavior of Republicans and using it because, you know, just because now it advances their ideas. So trying to sort of figure out a way around the way the Senate, you know, normally works to push through something. So, again, I think...
it's not a making up of rules, though. There are current rules that allow for this.
Sure, but there were rules that would have allowed the nuclear option, too.
I think that's a more debatable point.
Well, okay.
That would have required a rule change. I mean, you're allowed to change the rules, but it would
right.
be an actual changing of rules to have done that.
No, I get what you're saying. I think that when you're in the minority in terms of being a political party, that you make certain arguments, and when you're in the majority, you make certain arguments, unless you're very principled. And so there were definitely people there were Republicans who opposed the nuclear option on principle, and their argument was, If we do this, we're not always going to be in the majority. Someday we're going to be in the minority, and we don't want this to happen to us. So I just think it's interesting, and I think that there will be hypocrisy. There will be bloggers who spoke out, you know, against the tyranny of the majority, who are now completely fine with this. And you'll see hypocrisy on the other side too.
I want to. I only got a few minutes left before I have to run for. An interview, but I was intrigued by the reaction to the AIG resignation letter in the New York Times, which Hot Air called an example of going galt.
Right.
And I don't know if everybody knows what going galt is. So I thought maybe you could explain.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it comes from the book Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand. And essentially, if you read the book, and by the way, they're supposedly going to make a movie about this starring Angelina Jolie, and I really hope that comes out. But essentially, the book is about what happens when the people who actually produce goods, the people who actually start businesses, go on strike. And if you read the book, it's sort of interesting because it starts off where out of nowhere, you know, there'll be all this dialogue and someone will just say, "Who is John Galt?" And then it's completely apropos of nothing. But at the end, you find out what it is and who John Galt is. But this is an interesting phenomenon because essentially the New York Times was someone who was from AIG leaving. There was a conservative blogger recently or somewhere, I don't remember who it was, but had the idea that Rush Limbaugh would end his broadcast one day saying, "Who is John Galt? Turn off the system and never come back." And at first, Barack Obama's people would be very happy, but then there'd be this anger bubbling among the people. But what's really fascinating is as we've had this stimulus, as Obama's come to power, there's a resurgence of sort of libertarianism. You can see it if you listen to even Rush Limbaugh talking about now he's very concerned about things like government knowing too much about us. This is part of the reason that I actually got involved in the conservative movement. When I was in college, you know, in college it's very fun to be rebellious. And if you go to Shepherdstown, West Virginia, where I went to college, the best way to be rebellious is to be a conservative. And during the Clinton years, it was a lot more fun to be a conservative because you could sort of, you were like this libertarian conservative and, you know, love your country, fear your government kind of thing. That's having a resurgence right now. And part of it is that, and you can see it with the whole thing where the name escapes me right now, but the guy from CNBC went on that rant. It's really having a resurgence, and I think a lot of people are going to be reading Ayn Rand, and I think you're going to see things like these tea parties. It's going to be very interesting, and it's something to keep an eye on. It is a trend that will develop over time that no one's really talked about. Maybe I should blog it.
I guess that's the question. Is this the dawning of an era of liberalism or the spark of the Ayn Rand revolution?
And I think both are sort of, you know, you need one to have the other, actually.
So there'll be a grand final battle.
The Yankees need the Red Sox. Chuck Klosterman, are you familiar with Chuck's writing at all?
Yeah.
He had this big thing about everybody needs a nemesis, you know, like Batman needed, you know, the Joker or whomever.
It's also Star Trek VI.
Yes. So we'll do that thing. I can't even do it right. I'm doing my Vulcan symbol. For my money, The Wrath of Khan is the best.
Well, it is. I think that's accepted fact.
That's right.
Well, perhaps we should leave it there.
Yes, very good talking to you. Have fun at your interview. And we'll be here same bat time, same bat channel next week.
Excellent. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Take care.